Joining me in the Catalyst studio today is Tim Dutton with Unite Pinellas. Welcome.
Good to be here, Joe. Thanks.
So let's dig in a little bit to what Unite Pinellas is. You know, the last event was fantastic, a lot of great data. It's had an interesting origin. So can you share how it came about and what you're working on?
Sure. People who've been around in the community for 4 years or more know that about 4 years ago, the Tampa Bay Times did a really interesting series of articles that were really revelatory, and it was called Failure Factories. So it focused in on issues that relate to educational equity. It generated a lot of interest around in some of the organizations in the community who came together and really were concerned about what was evident in those sets of data. And those folks met pretty regularly, included JWB, the representative of the school board, the folks from the chamber, other governmental entities, ultimately the United Way of Suncoast, the Foundation for Healthy St. Pete, 20, 30 people on the list. And they talked a lot about what is it that we're really thinking we might be able to do, and ultimately came to focus on equity instead of just focusing on educational issues. Mm-hmm. It really was focusing on equity more broadly, really racial and income equity. So that becomes multidimensional, and education is one of those dimensions. So they chose to focus on equity. And we try to use terms like fairness and justice because equity is a loaded term that a lot of people aren't quite sure what it means and how is it different from equality and those kind of things. So when you think in terms of fairness and justice, those are terms around which people can resonate.
So a couple of logistical questions just for my own curiosity. So at that point, how long was the gap between when the articles came out and when they actually, it became official enough that they would have, you know, an employee? Yeah.
Well, so that was 4 years ago and I started a year and a half ago.
Okay. Took a while.
Yeah. But, you know, these are fundamentally the CEOs of these organizations, so their plate was pretty full otherwise.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately that's, they hired me in January of 2018.
And then, you know, obviously the Times, they put the original articles out. How much did they stay involved?
That information, that series of articles, I would argue, not to read the t-shirt on you, was the catalyst for this.
We can double entendre the Times. The Times is becoming the catalyst.
There you go.
How did you come to be attached to the organization and sort of what was your mandate when you came in?
So I have several decades of experience, as you can tell by my gray beard. And this feels a little bit like it is where many of the things that I've done were headed. So when I applied, they were looking pretty broadly for folks. I think that what they saw with me was somebody who understood data and understood sort of how it, when you focus on theories, there's this really wonderful quote that there's nothing more practical as a good theory. So I'm a big fan of thinking about how you think change actually might happen. Because if you don't think through that process, then everything seems okay to do. I think they recognize that. And frankly, I think this is a really significant issue that I'm humbled and everybody should be around the idea that this community wants to take this on.
And how change happens is something I spend a lot of time thinking on. So I'd love to dig into that a little bit. Let's talk about the elements that create change. Obviously, policy, communication. Can you tell me what the building blocks of change are?
So in this case, we're really focusing on how is it that you can move the needle with regard to issues that relate to equity. And you know, because you came to this event where we released an equity profile, that there are ways of measuring, in many instances, inequity. So when you think about trying to focus on making those metrics better, those measurements better, the best thinking around the country is that there are three things that can do that. Because equity or inequity was really a fabrication of national, federal public policy, inevitably, policy is one of the solutions, one of the things that's going to make things better. And we can get into some of that in a minute. But that's one. The second is that it's not just policies, but how is it that actual on-the-ground decision-making happens? So think in terms of whenever a lending decision to somebody occurs, and the policies don't say be biased, the policies say be fair. But in practice, there are discriminatory lending practices that were certainly a big deal through the history of this country, and were a big deal during the prime lending mortgage challenges started in 2008 or around that period. But recent research shows that they're again a big deal. There are places all over the country now that where they're seeing discriminatory lending practices blossoming. So think in terms of that kind of thing. Instead of policy, it's really about face-to-face decision-making. And the third one is that as a country, we have a narrative that plays itself out in terms of blame. The narrative often is, you're not doing well, well, that's your fault. And it operates especially around issues of that relate to income and poverty. But it really is the narrative that we've come to accept as being the standard narrative around meritocracy. And leaving out, frankly, the understanding that in many instances, a lack of opportunity because of the structural barriers that were put in place decades, if not centuries ago, the vestiges of those are still in place. And even current policy generates some of that disparity. So this narrative of blame, that's an area where work needs to be done. So two other things I want to mention. Those are the levers, if you will, to being mechanical, the levers for change. But there are two other phenomena that play themselves out when you think in terms of fairness and justice that we're talking about. One of them is that the national data, and I think it's true locally, about awareness is that the most people in the country, especially people who are white, don't think this is a problem. We resolved this in the 60s with all the civil rights actions. And some of the narrative that I just mentioned plays itself out then. There is the idea of increasing awareness, and the equity profile, the event that you attended, is one of the ways to do that, to just point out that yes, in fact, we are living in a community that, like most communities in the country, perhaps all, still have these differences of experience going on. Mm-hmm. So that's one. And then the second one is around equity specifically, is that the history, especially the history of that last 100 years, is that every time there's progress around these issues, there tends to be retrenchment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, immediately after all the pretty profound civil rights actions that happened in the 60s, there was the decision to the mass incarceration of African-American males. So that plays itself out in other instances as well.
And of course, we've seen that on the national political scene recently.
Even in the past several years.
Yeah. So I guess the one thing that, you know, I don't know that it's addressed in those elements of change is the racism itself. Because it seems like putting restrictive policies or compensatory policies in place are to help stem the effects, but don't necessarily address the cause. So how do you go about addressing the cause?
Well, part of this has to do with this narrative you just mentioned. It's, to be honest with you, the issues of racism are undergird everything we just talked about. Mm-hmm. One of the differences between what we're trying to do and what is often the case, and frankly, there's some good programs here, is this is not about programs. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the things that happens around programs are the participants may end up in a better place, but there's not significant broad-scale population change because there's not a whole lot of attention being paid to systems. So undergirding the systems that have created the policies is this two things. One, power differentials, power.
Right.
And the other one is the impact that racism's played out in terms of power and systems. So the intention here is that these three things are structural. So they're not ethereal. The intention is to attack the structures that have been put in place by racism that really, if you really think about what most people value, they're about fairness and fairness and opportunity and justice, having faith in having a just system. So when you think in terms of some of the stuff that was shown in this data, that's not what's going on right now. So the answer, I think, to the question, at least from our standpoint, is how do we create new structures that don't depend upon individual change, but are reliant on the power of new structures to ultimately change the issues of racism. So in addition to that, then the third one of these, this narrative change, I think starts talking about how do we talk about this stuff differently? Because if we don't, then there tends to erode any progress. I think that the structures, if they're strong enough, can endure that until there's more powerful narrative changes. But those all three have to happen, because if only two of them happen, then we're, first of all, this is the long haul.
Generational.
So when you deal with, exactly, when you deal with programs, you can see outcomes more quickly because you're focusing on a subset. But when you're dealing with systems change, it's really a little different time frame.
Yeah, and I think that narrative change, you know, obviously I'm in the communications business, and I think that's so largely left off the table and doesn't get the attention it deserves because, you know, you essentially need to come at it from both angles. You can legislate it from one end, but, you know, even if it works, if it's not amplified, even when you say in a, you know, in the perfect state of knowledge, people would move towards fairness and be okay with that. The challenge is to get the information out about the injustice. And, you know, in the same way, you know, I think that we are all largely the sum of our inputs, and our inputs are largely our media. And that's just, you know, for as much effort and money as we put into building structure to not, you know, really put effort into getting that same quality in our inputs.
It matters. And frankly, it's ubiquitous. Media is certainly a big piece of this, but it goes beyond that. Every sector tends to use language that reinforces this dynamic. So there's this guy at Berkeley named John Powell, who writes about othering. So when we talk about othering and you talk about them, and the obvious contrast to them is us.
Right.
So you've already created this duality.
Sure.
And that's exactly what we do. The nonprofit sector does this, the philanthropic sector does this, government does this, and certainly the media does this. So these are the kinds of language issues. And it's not just language. You know, Kenny Irby, who's a photojournalist by training and history, he and I have talked about the images that we use to project, you know, issues that have to do with good and bad and blame and virtue and that kind of stuff. And they're everywhere. You don't have to look hard to find them if you're awoken to them.
And certainly, I mean, that, you know, biologically, we're tribal, you know, your family and your tribe through many, many generations. But at the same time, I think having that knowledge, then doesn't that implore you to make an effort to say, for example, we have a section in the Catalyst called The Hustle, and it's just formulaic questions.
Mm-hmm.
They're straight, and anybody can come and put their small business up on there. And whether it's, you know, a coffee shop on the south side or a coffee shop on the north side, it's all the same. And I think, not that we did that intentionally for that purpose, but I think that becomes a way to counteract some of those language things, to create platforms that are static and let people express themselves within them. And then, you know, work, make an effort to spread that out to as many, you know, people.
Well, it's going to take a really broad-based effort around the language stuff, but it has to have an intentionality. It sounds like you guys are trying to be intentional about the language. I don't know to what degree that's true in all sectors and certainly in all media, but the idea that we think in terms of language, which includes images and includes stories and jokes and everything else, then until we are aware that many of those perpetuate, you know, it's true of all the isms, but it's certainly true of racism.
Sure. Yeah. And it goes back to, they're not, this wouldn't be a conversation we're having if the media was doing it right.
Yeah.
But really, to me, the conversation is more about division of resources for efforts like your own to say, yeah, because we do see a lot of it around policy.
Yeah.
And there's certainly, you know, awareness that communication is important. We had Dr. John Ellen in from Johns Hopkins, and he talked about how we've essentially not cured HIV, but you can go. And yet that information and the opportunity to live isn't even penetrating the Black community from an information standpoint. And I would love to see more of our resources be tied to that and, you know, and to give it equal weight with the policy work.
When we talk about the levers for change, it's, to some degree, the policy one is a more simple one.
Yes.
And I hesitate to say that because the more I've learned about the policies that are impacting the issue of equity, wow, they're complicated and they're everywhere. But when we talk about the institutional practices, you know, I use the banking example, that's very difficult to unearth and then very difficult to impact. So that's the second one, at least the order we do them. And the third one, this narrative change, it's very complex because it's day-to-day language that isn't media. You know, one of the places we're going to start around the, all of these, and it shows up on the policy practice and narrative, is we want to start with the nonprofit sector mm-hmm. and the philanthropic sector, because nationally, these two sectors, the leadership is white and the boards are white.
Mm-hmm.
What the data shows is when that's not the case, the decisions are different. And right behind that white leadership and that those white board members are more white leadership and board members. So we think there's a chance here because of the focus on equity for this community, those two sectors in particular, to have sufficient resources to capacity, if you will, to start changing that and to start methodically, intentionally start creating mechanisms for leadership to be not all white. And that will help as well. And again, it's long term, but it's also about power and it's about impact.
And so how do you map capacity building to that specific change?
Well, fortunately, there's a fair amount written because those sectors nationally have looked at themselves over the past 10 years and been very self-critical. Now, that's easy to do, but it's hard to implement the change. So what we're trying to do, we are bringing together some folks in those sectors to start charting out what is it that we can learn from the how some organizations are making those change happen, and then how do we build the capacity in this community to help more organizations make that change happen. I would argue that we need to hold ourselves to account. In this case, when I'm saying we, I'm not a big pronoun fan. I need to be careful about that because pronouns tend to be an opportunity to other. But what Unite Pinellas is going to try to do is say that we will be accountable for impacting this in the nonprofit and philanthropic sectors. So this is a reasonable thing to hold us to account. So we're creating processes for helping make that happen.
Can you articulate a few of those?
Well, you know, one of the first things that you end up doing is inevitably is talking to the boards of the organizations, because that's really where some fundamental change not only has to happen inside the board, but for the rest of the staff. And it's not just, by the way, a function of numbers. It's also a function of sort of filters, if you will. So how is your procurement policy put together? And how is it that the decision-making process happens? How is it that issues of fairness and equity play themselves out in grant making? So you would start with doing a self-analysis, and that is about the numbers, and then start asking questions. Unite Pinellas will not be the organization that does that, but we hope to identify some organizations that will develop that expertise, if not already have that expertise, and then come up with ways to make that more democratized for the nonprofit and philanthropic sectors.
And so with that in, say, a 3-year to 5-year timeframe, what would be some things that you would consider successes?
Yeah, it's interesting because before April 18th, Joe, I don't know that I would have anticipated that 350 people would show up for an event that's focused exclusively on equity. But as a consequence of that, there are people who hunger for making impact occur, and they've reached out. So I think that there's some opportunities to do some specific policy changes, and I'll give you one that I'm particularly interested in. Around the country, there's some attention being paid now to the fees and fines that are being imposed by governments as a mechanism for increasing revenue. And those have become sort of much more the mechanism for increasing revenue over the past 20 years. Since 1996, more than 20 new fees and fines have been imposed by the state of Florida. And they have also imposed mechanisms for making it so that local jurisdictions can't excuse anybody based upon their ability to pay. So if you look at how this has played itself out nationally and locally, and by the way, there's a relatively new organization, national organization called Fees and Fines Justice Center. Mm. So it's that big a deal.
All right.
The Fees and Fines Justice Center is spending most of its time in two states, and Florida is one of them. But it's not just at the state scale. We haven't done the local analysis, but it also happens at county and municipal scales. San Francisco County and San Francisco City have spent the last couple of years looking at this because there's 21,000 people in San Francisco County that were unable to pay and were impacted by that. So what happens sometimes, and all the times, but a lot of times, is people end up in jail. So it fundamentally becomes a debtor prison. So because of your inability to pay, you end up in jail. That's unconstitutional. So this has gotten to be sort of a big deal. There just isn't very many places aside from a couple examples in California, and frankly, a couple in Florida, where governments have taken this issue on. And I think that may be one where we can, I mean, it's really hard not to get behind that, because it isn't. You don't think of it in terms of radical politics because it is about fairness. Because as soon as somebody ends up in jail, they're going to lose their job and they're not going to be with their family. So these have a big cost to them. And it's, the reality also is that, for example, in Los Angeles County, in one of their court systems, they were spending more money to in the administration of the collection of the fines than they were getting in revenue. So it's not only has this dimension to it that seems unfair,
right,
but it's also not very efficient. And, you know, there was a Supreme Court ruling last fall that basically said you can't have a fee and a fine that's unfair. So there's new energy around this. And I think this might be one that we could get into pretty quickly. And frankly, when we talk about policy, it starts unearthing itself in sort of really unexpected places. So this would be one of those examples. And I got to think, you know, Pinellas County, from a population standpoint, is bigger than San Francisco County.
Huh.
So I think that we're going to see big numbers like that here.
And obviously, when you throw in the cost of incarceration, then it blows the numbers out of the water.
Absolutely, because, you know, you just can't collect enough money to pay for that.
So I want to jump back a bit. When you were talking about some of the things that needed to happen, you were going to focus around nonprofits and some of the self-assessments. And then I'm assuming following self-assessments were some best practices.
Yeah.
And you said you wouldn't be the group to leave that. Who will be?
Well, we don't know that yet. So that's part of the capacity building we need to do as a community. That's part of the process. I mean, to some degree, we're the program of work is just now starting to play itself out. So this is one. And to be honest with you, as much as anything, this is so important because it's hard to talk about equity if, in fact, the landscape of the institutions that are trying to take it on aren't practicing equity.
Sure.
So that's a piece of what we think has to be done early. But it's not just that. I do think that we're going to be going down multiple paths. One of these is, as you said, the issues relate to institutional DEI work and diversity, equity, and inclusion. But then I think there are opportunities around policy that we'll be working on pretty quickly. And I think around practice, there will be. The one that we're really struggling with, to be honest with you, is around the narrative change and how to impact that. And there are a couple organizations nationally that care about this, but it's hard to find a place that's really taking it on as a community.
There are some, I consider, fairly low-hanging fruit solutions that we started down a path, and we had an initiative called the Media Equity Initiative. And we gathered a few of the publications in the area. I won't name them all, but basically, the Weekly Challenger is a great longstanding information source in the Black community. We, you know, brought Lynn in, and you know, the idea was that we would bring some of the more traditionally distributed to white media outlets, talk about what kind of content they needed, and then employ the, you know, to get some diversity in the subject matter for that content.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would agree to publish it. You know, we were even going to throw some money in to boost those posts so that I like to throw layers of win into everything that we do. And so there you have this good information going out there. There's a diversity element to it. It becomes, we were going to pay for the content, so it becomes free content to the outlet and even some boosting to grow the readership as well. And those are the kind of things I think that can be, you know, for as easy as it is to just put, you know, a few pieces of content out that show the coffee shop, and I used that example before on the South Side, enough people are going to see that, they're going to go visit it. And then that's where you start to get some of that narrative change just simply by people being together.
Well, one of the things that's, and you're getting at this and what you just said, one of the things is that the typical stories that are told about neighborhoods that are neighborhoods of color or in areas that are economically marginalized is that it's all about the negative. It's only about the negative. And the truth is there's also a whole lot of good stuff going on, you know, and that just never makes its way into the media because that's not what sells. But there's plenty of good stories to tell.
Right.
I mentioned the asset-based community development. That's one of the things they do is they emphasize the need to have increased positive news about places that are considered to be absent that.
You know, there are people who want to sell things or find ways to reach pretty much everybody. And so if those paths exist, they can be used for other purposes as well.
Yeah, that's right. There's more that can be done around this. And maybe this is an opportunity for us to sit together and talk about how that might be the case with our two organizations.
That'd be great. And a plug also, I appreciate you'll be joining us for the upcoming Tiger Bay events on equity with a great panel.
I look forward
to it. And we're excited to hear more of your insights there. I hope everybody listening will make sure to attend that. And we'll put a link to it in the show notes. Thank you for coming in.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for your good work.
You're welcome.